Welcome to the Eat, Train, Prosper podcast, where we provide you sustainable training principles for strength and building muscle, effective nutrition practices for improving and maintaining a lean physique, and practical lifestyle habits for becoming a champion of your own health, both inside and out. Hosted by Aaron Straker and Brian Borstein. Happy Tuesday, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Eat, Train, Prosper. Today is a rapid fire Q&A episode that Brian and I have going on. Brian got a bunch of really, really cool questions. I would even maybe say bombarded with questions from a little Instagram Q&A box. So before we can jump into all these questions, Brian, what's the latest with you?
Yeah, it's interesting about that Q&A box, huh? Because we were just talking before a show, and I put up one originally to get questions a couple days prior, and I literally only got 5 questions, and every single question was a nutrition one, which just seems crazy from, like, you know, what I do and what you do, and that all these nutrition questions would come into me. So then I put up another box for training questions, and I got like 25 of them or something crazy like that. So for whatever reason, that's the way the internets were working. And now we have a cool mix of nutrition questions and training questions and a couple lifestyle questions too. So we'll get into that in a minute. But what is going on with me is that I'm in week 3 of my strength phase. It's going great. I decided to join a local CrossFit gym. It's actually CrossFit Sanitas, which anyone that's in the CrossFit community would know that that is the gym owned by the new owner of CrossFit, the new CEO. So I attend that gym, which is kind of cool. And I know that he has like Froning and a bunch of the kind of name faces of CrossFit come by the gym a couple times a year, and they have events there. And I think last time they actually hiked Sanitas, the mountain. So there's always like kind of cool stuff happening there. And it's like a really big, really nicely well done gym. So I'm excited to do my strength work there. It was really nice yesterday for my first session to be able to squat without the constraints of my teeny home gym kind of suffocating me. So I had tons of space, you know, light coming through the windows. There was a CrossFit class going on that I could like watch people between sets. And it was cool. It was just a great experience overall. The strength cycle going well so far. All the lifts are going up. I pulled a 455 deadlift single at like an RPE 7 yesterday, and that was probably like the easiest 455 I've ever pulled. So that was a good sign. And squatting's going well too, just kind of progressing along, adding 5 pounds a week. And dumbbell pressing, actually, so this is really interesting because I know you have been doing the Cass style pressing where the elbows kind of stay in and the bicep comes across and adducts across the body, right? So I kind of like half-ass tried to do that last cycle, like months ago, but my ego would always get in the way. And when the weights would get heavy, I would hit a sticking point kind of just above or right before lockout, and my elbow would turn out. So I wasn't able to keep kind of driving across the body. It kind of would get to about here, and then the elbow would turn out and I would finish, you know, with the help of my anterior delts. So this cycle, given that it's a strength cycle and my goal is to stay like, you know, 5 reps shy of failure or whatever on every set, I figured it'd be a perfect time to actually implement that and force myself to work through it and not just get like sidetracked because my ego's hurt that I'm not doing the hundreds anymore. So I started with the 85s and it was super awkward at first. The first week I only hit 4 sets of 5 and I stopped after 4 sets because, the rep began to slow. That's kind of what I'm trying to avoid, is concentric speed slowing. So my final rep of that 4th set slowed and I was like, okay, 4 sets of 5, that's all I can do. And now, 2 weeks after that, I hit 6 sets of 6 with the same weight and there was no slowing. So I've added, you know, 2 sets and added a bunch of reps, 36 total reps instead of 20 total reps. So that's a huge increase and I'm feeling much more confident with that movement pattern. Cass told me that it would adapt really quickly if I just like started doing it and stopped giving in. And so I'm really glad that I gave that a shot. And I know that you've kind of been experiencing a lot of the same adaptations as you've become more technically proficient at that movement style.
Yes. For me, interestingly enough, it just feels better.
I would agree with that.
It feels a lot safer and natural for me. So it was kind of an easy shift. Mm-hmm. And yeah, kind of same thing. it's really nice when you switch, because the neural adaptations, like it is a big kind of an asterisk, right? So I'm like, the weights are going up, but it's a movement I haven't performed in this capacity consistently for like years. So I know it's like, you know, kind of like artificial gains, right? Not yeah. true gains. But it is still motivating per se to be like, okay, can I, you know, squeeze out an extra rep this week type of thing. So it is pretty cool.
Yeah. No, for sure. When I, when the reps get hard, and it's not like, you know, a rep speed is slowing, but you can just kind of feel what's happening as the reps get harder throughout. And it's crazy, because when I would begin to do hard reps and my elbow would turn out, it would be like the failure was almost like a stability failure. It would be like, is my delt going to hold on long enough for me to lock this rep out? But this way, when fatigue is happening, it's literally happening like in the chest. Like you can feel the chest moving the weight, and the adduction of the chest is what's ascending the dumbbells, so to speak. So that's cool. And then one other thought I just had on this is, when I was up at N1 talking to Cass, I originally demoed it to him in the way that I was performing it on a low incline. And he was like, well, the way that your body is made up in your torso position in your chest, you can't really do an incline press in this manner, because what happens is you get to about 3/4 of the way up and the dumbbell is too high over your face at this point. So you're no longer actually staying in the active range of the chest. So he put me down onto a flat bench. And he was like, see how when you get to the top of the rep now that the dumbbell is still over the top of your chest and not over your face. And so that was really interesting to me too, because I've always preferred incline pressing. And I wonder if that's just because it played into my anterior delt dominance. And I never really let my chest fully do it. So all very interesting. And then I even wonder if like a slight decline would put me into even a better position that would allow me to kind of train across the fiber length of where the pecs actually run. But whether that matters, I don't exactly know either. So all very interesting. And I know you have your N1 trip booked for December. So that should be super, super hype, dude. I'm glad to hear. I'm excited to hear all about
that. Yeah. So I snuck into that the last practical of the year. After that, a couple episodes back, you said it was sold out, and I like kind of had a little shit fit. So I'm going, Jenny's coming too, actually, which is pretty cool. And then we actually decided, so it's kind of funny, when we travel, we almost like exclusively stay in Airbnbs because I want a kitchen type of deal. But this time we actually, there is a hotel that's like a few minutes walking distance to the N1 HQ. And you're like, you know what, let's stay at the hotel. It's going to be a little bit of an extended trip, and we're going to like put together, not necessarily like a protocol, but like a game plan for clients when traveling in hotels for like eating. So we're like, okay, this is what we're going to get to the grocery store. We have a mini fridge and a microwave. Like what are we going to figure out? So kind of using it as, I mean, it's obviously a work trip, but in an additional layer of like, okay, what meals can we do with just a microwave to put together better options for our clients too.
It's a double business expense.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm very, very excited about that. And then what else for me? Moving next week to Scottsdale, Arizona. It is officially winter here in Utah. The Canyons have like a bunch of snow and the roads are closed and stuff like that. We're like going with like, you know, chains and stuff. So it is, weather's not great. So we are heading out next week, which was the plan, right? November 4th, we leave, going to spend like 3 to 4 months in Scottsdale. So any listeners out there, if you are Scottsdale, Phoenix area, hit me up. I'd love to lift some weights, maybe get some coffee, go on a hike or something like that. That will be coming very soon. I'm about almost halfway through my gut protocol. Not quite. I would say things are still hit or miss right now. Some days I still do get kind of gassy. It is interesting to me trying to kind of pinpoint specifically what it is, because my days are very, very similar. A lot of the same foods and stuff. So it is, I think it might be certain volumes of certain types at certain points of the day relation to how quickly I put things, you know, in my stomach or in my GI, I guess I should say, relative to the previous feeding sort of thing. So still just cruising along there. And then kind of last updates, I'm getting a DEXA scan before we leave the day before. When I got the one back in August, I bought two because it was like half the second price. I was like, okay, whatever, I'll come back before we leave. So I'll go get that done. and I'm going to get some sex hormone lab work as well. So my coach has been asking just because we've stayed much leaner than kind of thought would be possible, just to make sure that I'm not like downregulated thyroid, downregulated total free testosterone, you know, sex hormone binding globulin stuff. So I'm really interested in that too, because this is a first for me personally to be this lean at this amount of calories and stuff. So it kind of just, to me, goes, I'll often say with clients, like it's a long game, right? This nutrition physique thing, it's a long game, and it only continues to become more and more true for myself. Like the longer I do it, the more times I go through that, like, you know, gaining and then dieting process, I never put on as much body fat on the way back up. I'm significantly leaner now in my, you know, I'm approaching my mid 30s here than I was well, you know, in my 20s and stuff like that. I truly do believe I have more muscle mass. I actually found an old picture of us, Brian, that I've been meaning to post. I screenshotted it. I think it's from like 2013, 2014. And it's you and I standing right next to each other. And we both have our shirts off, which is like kind of odd for that time period for myself. So it'll be a pretty cool thing. But I mean, we both definitely look much better now. And though I think this picture is literally like 8 years ago. So it is pretty cool to see.
You know, we also have that one of the whole like CrossFit PB team, like standing in a line with like Kuchan and all the girls and stuff too. That one's dope. But I think that one's done up so much by Hammer that I think it doesn't represent like our physiques necessarily in their like natural
state. Yeah, it's not it's a highlight. Like that one's like a highlight, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not
candy. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Cool. Do you have anything else?
Last thing I will say is like my training's going really well. I'm really enjoying it. I'm feeling strong, which is cool because I'm like small and, you know, lean, and you generally don't kind of correlate the two, but I'm adding, you know, reps each week, weight each week. I'm really liking the DDP progression style. Like last week I had a session where I just could feel it wasn't going to be great, and I just reduced everything and stayed in my same rep ranges and just like, you know, I didn't take it as like a negative like I normally would have. Yeah, it's just really wild, you know, still stacking weight on and videoing myself more and more, which I'm finding is becoming more and more important, because there's a dichotomy between how you feel in a set often and what it looks like on video. So I put up on my story, maybe it was like a week ago, I added like almost 20 pounds in a single hack squat session because I watched the first set and I was like, oh, whoa, yep, that's moving way too fast. And I literally had to just keep putting more weight on. And that was like I'm now up like 30 pounds from what I was doing for same reps, just because I videoed a couple sets and was like, oh shit, those are moving really fast. So it's just another thing. It's like the more data you have, it's always going to help you make better decisions.
Yeah, I would say my phone is probably filled with about 90% of workout videos for me, because I actually do film every work set I do. Like occasionally I'll film a warm up set if it's like a deadlift and I just want to make sure that, like, you know, my back position is good, whatever, whatever. But I literally film every work set I do. Even of the like six sets of six of press that I was doing that I referenced earlier, I filmed four of those just because I was like, okay, I want to see how my elbow angle looks like from this side and from that side and from above, and like just to kind of get like different perspectives of what it looks like from different angles. And I think that I learned something, you know, each time I look at that.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I have a couple more small updates and then we'll jump into the Q&A. Finally now, 1 day away from 4 weeks in, I feel like my scrotum is recovered. So it was a significantly longer experience recovery than I wanted and expected. It was a bit of a mind fuck, to be honest. But, the other day, 2 days ago, I was out going for a walk and I was like, wow, I feel great. Like there's no pain. There's no like, you know, awareness around it. So I was like, let me start jogging and just see if it feels okay. You know, I did a slow jog for like 200 meters and that felt fine. So I walked a little more. Then I did like a hard jog for 200 meters and that felt fine. And then I did a sprint for 200 meters and I was kind of like, ooh, I feel something, like, you know, definitely like I'm aware, but it wasn't like painful. So while I wouldn't say that I'm like 100% healed, I'm at least able to run and jump and like for the most part live my life. And I think that it is healing. I mean, if I still come back 4 weeks from now and say, yep, still hurts if I sprint, like I think we're going to have a problem. But I'm optimistic now that the healing has begun and I should be good to go. Beyond that, I have a much better grasp on my nutrition situation now. My body weight is stable at 190, like I mentioned last episode. We're at 190 again this week. It's nice having, I now have Kim as an accountability partner. So Kim and I decided just literally off the cuff of our sleeve. Like we were talking to another couple that was like, you know, the best thing to do in the winter with your little kids is go to an all-inclusive resort. And they have like, you know, these childcare areas that are open from like 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. So you can just drop them there whenever you want free time. So we looked into it. Like literally this all came together this week and we booked a 4-night, 5-day stay in Cancun at an all-inclusive resort for January. So Kim is now on this mission to get in shape for her bikini in Cancun. And it's nice for me that we both kind of have each other as these accountability partners. And we're taking an approach with Sunday through Thursday being our like, you know, really dialed in, like no added sugars type thing. And then Friday night and Saturday, we can kind of like eat out and maybe have a dessert or something like that. And then when Sunday rolls around, we're going to get back on the accountability train and we'll see how that works out. Cause that allows us to still have like a date night and stuff like
that. Does this mean you're going to hang up your baking apron for a couple months?
Yeah, I'm not going to bake except maybe on the weekends. Well, maybe like a Saturday, you know, evening or something we'll bake and then get back on the train on Sunday. So all good stuff. I'm excited about our trip. I'm excited about, you know, the way I feel eating better. And that's pretty much it on my updates.
Cool. You want to dig in? Want me to kick this first one over to you?
How about I ask you some of these nutrition ones?
Okay, that's fine.
Because I at least think the first question, like I kind of looked at it and I was like, I don't know. Okay. So I'm wondering if you have thoughts on this. Does a higher fat macro split tend to favor a lifestyle lean aesthetic or is this anecdotal?
So I would say this is anecdotal. Lifestyle lean is a hard, it's incredibly subjective, of course. I don't mean that in a negative manner, but I mean, someone could consider like lifestyle lean, like 18% body fat. You know, I would consider lifestyle lean like 11 for me personally, maybe 12 because that's my lifestyle. You know what I mean? I'm a nutrition coach, of course. So it depends. I hate using that, but it really does. I think you could go either way as long as you have kind of constraints that allow you to exist within those, you know, constraints, I guess I should say, without too much deviation. What I will add is, previously, almost exclusively, I had followed a higher carbohydrate approach, but right now I'm kind of being, for the first time, seeing the opposite, where I am following a higher fat approach. I wish I had the numbers. I meant to write them down, but I'm doing like right now my carbs on a training day are only 220, right? Pretty low, specifically for this gut protocol. My fats are at like 130, I think. Yeah, 130 and then 135 on my rest days. So it is a pretty good, I'm probably balanced, if not a little bit higher fat. I can't do those numbers off the top of my head. I'm sorry. But I'd say it is mostly anecdotal. There are certain things that could influence it. And this could shift with changes in your physiology. Let's say other aspects of your lifestyle, your sleep, stress, et cetera, begin to improve your insulin sensitivity over time. You might find that you can now tolerate more carbohydrate because of those kind of external factors. So it is anecdotal. There are factors that can shift back and forth, but I would say it's more anecdotal than anything.
Yeah, my opinion on it would be that total calorie intake is going to move the needle more as far as whether you remain lean or not, and it doesn't exactly matter the fat and the carb. Personally, I've gone through periods of time where I actually was on like a 33-33-33 split. And so it ended up being like on a 3000 calorie intake, that's like 250 protein, 250 carbs, and like 120 fat or something like that. And that was fine. Like I enjoyed it. I don't think that it allowed me to do the peri-workout thing, which I really actually do like. And so that's one drawback, I guess, to having a higher fat intake is it kind of messes up your ability to carb and protein around the training sessions. Cool. Next question. Is it possible to go too slow in a building phase, i.e. 100 calorie increase every 3 weeks versus every week?
It is possible to go too slow. It's possible to go too fast. If you're going too slow, your weight's not changing. That would be the most obvious indicator. Mm-hmm. I would say follow your body weight trends more importantly than following I'm increasing X every X weeks. So pick a number and kind of scoot that along until you start getting a trend that is positive for your weights. Average them over like a 7-day moving average is the best, in my opinion, and see. And that is what I would recommend for that.
Yeah, I mean, if you're increasing 100 calories every 3 weeks, like over the course of 15 weeks, you're going to be eating 500 calories more, which is, I think, relatively significant. This is a female asking the question as well, for whatever it's worth. So I think a 500 calorie increase over a couple months is a significant increase. So I don't think 100 every 3 weeks is too slow, but you definitely could go too slow or you could go too fast. For sure.
I would recommend slower is better. And also just know that like 100 calories it depends on your consistency and adherence too, right? Because if you're off by a little bit in either direction, you know, over a handful of days, like that's a wash pretty much. So, just know that too.
Yeah. When you're increasing by small margins, there definitely is more room for error. Yeah. Like, yeah, being off by 20 calories is, you know, a much bigger percentage of your increase. Okay. Aaron, what are your thoughts on sucralose? Avoid it or don't worry
about
it?
This is really cool, 'cause I actually did a big deep dive on this last week. Depends on your digestion. So if you are someone who's gassy, like myself, if you look at the research, the most kind of up to date we have on it is in people who have some digestive intolerances or not super strong digestion as is, sucralose can give you a little bit more gassiness as opposed to like stevia, monk fruit extract, or even like, you know, table sugar. Is that what they call it? Mm-hmm. Table sugar? Table salt, table sugar, whatever. You get what I'm saying. Regular sugar.
Yes, regular
sugar. If you're someone who like doesn't have like gas or any kind of GI type stuff and you have a really, really like solid type stomach, I'm using like air quote stomach by GI, I mean, I don't think it's water under the bridge. I don't think it's worth, avoiding or anything like that. But if you are someone who gets like gassy or whatever, it might behoove you to try temporarily to move from like a sucralose based protein powder to like a stevia based and just see.
Yeah. I personally don't have issues with sucralose, but what I do notice is that if I don't use it for a while and then I do use it again, I hold water for a number of days afterwards. Like literally the scale can jump 3 pounds, 4 pounds with no other changes in the diet aside from just, you know, now I've consumed a Quest bar and something else with sucralose. And I don't usually do that. So that's interesting. But as far as like health and long-term stuff, like the science hasn't shown it to be dangerous. Like all these sweeteners are not worth worrying about unless you're literally drinking like 100 liters of Coke, Diet Coke.
Every day. I think from a health standpoint, there are no like Western medical type adverse health risks. If you are someone who has digestive issues, that is where it will show up first.
Yeah. So these next two questions are very related. I actually think they may be from the same person. So I'm going to slam them together into one. I've been on a cut to lean out. Is it bad to be on a cut for too long? I think the quick answer there is yes. The second part of the question is, how long should cuts and bulks be till you hit your goals, or what is the recommendation?
So I'll answer them separately. So if you've been on a cut to lean out, is it bad to be on a cut for too long? It can. Well, yes. It depends relative on your definition of bad. What generally happens is people say they're on a cut, but then they're like, oh, well, I have a bachelor party and then I took this week off and then I did these other things. So like you're not on a deficit. You're just going like you're yo-yo dieting is essentially what you're doing. So that is when it gets to be like too long. Like if we talk about your natural bodybuilding competitors, they'll diet for like 8 months. they might have, you know, refeeds and stuff like that, but they are actively dieting. So just make sure that you are setting proper constraints on what you're saying, what you're doing. Depends on how much weight you want to lose, right? If you're like, hey, I'm 270 pounds and I want to be 200 pounds, that might be pretty long. You would benefit from having diet breaks, et cetera. But if you're like, hey, I'm, you know, 15% body fat, I want to be 11%, I need to lose 18 pounds. You can diet for 20 weeks. I don't see anything really wrong with that. So long as you do your due diligence and go through a recovery diet and stuff afterward. Moving into the second part, how long should cuts and bulks be? It depends. I'm sorry for using that word, but it really, really does.
You have no context.
So I don't really see any benefit to doing either for less than like 6 weeks, unless you're like mini cutting for something. But you're already obviously very well versed there. Personally, I think pushing like a bulk or a gaining, what I like to refer to it as, until you've had like significant movement or changes, right? If you bulk or gain and you're up like 4 pounds and it's been 5 weeks and you're going to cut, like you're just going to look exactly like you did when you started. And you just basically wasted the last 4 weeks of gaining and 5-6 weeks of dieting to just end up where you were when you started, type of deal. So I recommend carving the time out, making them longer relative to your goal. But I would say I lean more towards let's hit your goals and then map out how long is an appropriate timeline for us to do so.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with all of that. I feel like even if you're doing the yo-yo dieting thing where like you have the bachelor party and the birthday, so like every, you know, week or two, you're taking a couple days off of the diet, I don't even know that that necessarily extends your runway like that much longer, because I don't know that a couple days here and there is long enough to really reset like ghrelin leptin stuff and like really get hormone production back into like more of an anabolic state. Like I feel like it's like, you know, the house is on fire and you're just like throwing one or two buckets on and walking away and hoping that like that helps versus like actually really putting the fire out. So for whatever that's worth.
Not so much from like a ghrelin and leptin perspective, but in terms of like, okay, we've been dieting for 3 weeks, right? You're down 3 pounds. You go on a bachelor party, you come back up 5 pounds. And we're kind of like starting over type of deal.
Right.
For someone like yourself, Brian, because you've invested so much time and drops in that bucket, those things will shift much more quickly. But for your average, like, you know, dieter, that's just not the case. You know, I've clients who come back from something and they're up and it takes us another 3 weeks just to get back to where they were before the wedding or something like that. So now, you know, we've been effectively 7 weeks of diet and we're only back to where we were at week 3 type of deal. So I'd say for your majority gen pop person, the latter is much more of a realistic scenario, unfortunately.
It is what it is. You make the best of it. Cool. So the last nutrition question we have is interesting. And I think there's two ways you could look at it because it's not super specific. It says nutrition and lifestyle tips for a college student who doesn't want to miss out. My question is, do you not want to miss out on partying and hanging out with girls, or do you not want to miss out on making gains? Because I think that you could take that question in either direction.
I'm going to take it from the former, right? this is a really, really cool question. I think I would avoid trying to diet much. I would spend the majority of those years focusing on building muscle. You're young still. You should have hormones in a really good position, hopefully still, even though you're drinking alcohol and your sleep is shit and all that other type of like college stuff. But dieting, in my, you know, opinion, was only going to redact from that. So I would avoid trying to stay too lean. I'd say maybe 15 to 20% body fat. I'd say in college, I probably stayed around 20% mostly. And I lifted 5 days per week. You know, I still ate protein and stuff like that, but I drank a lot. You know, I fortunately didn't do much drinking like, you know, Monday through Wednesday type of deal, but definitely on the weekends, you know, a lot. I would say, yeah, trying to just focus more on getting strong and building muscle as opposed to dieting would probably be the best of both worlds.
Yeah, I fully agree. Actually, our college experiences, based on that, like, three sentences you just put together, were like identical. I pretty much drank hard like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, sometimes Sunday, and then lifted 5 days a week, like no questions asked. I'd even wake up Friday morning hungover and, you know, go to the gym and flip flops and do arms. So you just kind of if you hit your protein goals, you make sure you're not in a deficit. So you're in a surplus with sufficient protein, and you're lifting weights 4 or 5 days a week, you should be able to go out and have fun and enjoy everything and still make progress because you're young and your testosterone is flowing and all these things. And then as far as, you know, ultimately you don't want to go 4 years and never be able to be like, I wonder if like I actually look good under here or not. So what I would usually do is, you know, college ends pretty early, like in May or something like that, right? Like it ends way earlier than high schools do. So I would usually start like a 6 week, you know, mini cut, like a pretty aggressive mini cut right after the year ended when I was home and I was like living with my parents again. And there was really nothing to do except lift weights and eat homemade food. And I would start running and like shit like that. And over 6 weeks, I would drop, you know, 12 pounds and I would go on a beach trips and stuff over the summer and I'd look good. And then, you know, school would start again and I'd go back to being 15 to 20% fluffy. So, that worked out pretty well. And I think that would probably be the way I'd approach it.
I personally didn't do that cause I just wasn't on my radar, but I agree with that. I think that's a really viable approach.
Yeah, cool. Well, now we're moving to a bunch of training questions.
Yep, I will read these ones for you. Studies or new findings that have changed the way you train and program?
Yeah, I love this question. I think the very obvious answer is the lengthened overload stuff. I mean, we've harped on this now for probably 10 or 12 episodes at least. And the studies are very obvious at this point that the initial range of motion of a lift, the part that goes from the stretched position to get the weight moving, is the most beneficial part, and that the part where you actually contract the muscle is the least important part. So that's definitely changed the way I train, you know, adding partials in the length and position after reaching failure on a short range overload movement. And then I think the other thing is, you know, a couple of years ago, we had this obsession in the evidence-based space with volume. It was like volume's everything. You know, there was the Brad Schoenfeld meta-analysis, and there was the study that like 45 sets was better than 27 sets, which was better than 9 sets, and like all these things. And I feel like now in the last year or two, we're finally like coming back to center and we're realizing like, hey, you know, effort is important and execution is important and not all volume is created equal. Like one person can do, if their bench press max is 300 pounds and they just did sets of 135 pounds for 10, you could do 100 sets of 135 for 10. And that's volume is going to be very ineffective because it's 40% of your max or whatever it is. And you're not even getting close to failure in those sets of 10. So not all volume is created equal. There's a volume effort ratio. So I think that's important, that the harder you work, the less volume you do, and the less hard you want to work, the more volume you can do. And I would say those are the two biggest takeaways recently for me.
The way you phrased that end part is fantastic. Not all volume is created equal. And this is something that I am beginning to learn like more and more about and just trying to become as efficient as possible with each set. So yeah, you answered that really, really well. I'm going to flop and answer or ask this number three, and then we'll pop back to number two because it's really relative.
Okay.
On days with a lengthened overload squat, would you prefer lengthened or short overload leg extension as a secondary movement?
Yeah. So for the listeners, essentially what they're asking is like, since most squat movements, pretty much all squat movements are overloaded in the lengthened position, like the hardest point is going to be the bottom or the bottom middle of the rep. Assuming you're doing a squat as your primary lift, what would be the best use of the leg extension exercise? Would you want to overload it lengthened or overload it shortened? And I actually, it's funny to hear this question because it was something I really thought about a lot in my last cycle as I was going through my diet and I had my days split up and stuff. So I had one leg day where I did the leg extension shortened, and I put that on. Well, actually, it doesn't matter because I had a squat pattern on both days. But I think the answer to this question is that the leg extension shortened is probably better with the lengthened overload squat so that you get a little bit of both. what I did in my cycle, to go back to that, is that I had one day where I did leg extension shortened overload, and then I moved to a pendulum, which was I moved to the hack. On the day it was short overload, I moved to the hack because that's a lengthened overload. And the day that I did leg extension with a lengthened overload, I went to the pendulum, but I had it reverse banded so that it was harder in the top range of motion. So I think that if you can figure out a way to create a squat pattern movement that isn't as lengthened overload, then that would be a good day to put a lengthened overload leg extension on so that you kind of get the stimulus from both sides.
One thing I want to kind of ask you and clarify. So with your leg extension machine at home and your home gym, you can change the overload position, correct? Based on like the...
Correct, yes.
Can you explain that a little bit? Because in a gym, I would say 9 out of 10, you're unable to do that, correct?
Correct. Yeah. But you know, it's interesting because the Valor leg extension, leg curl machine, the Titan, and the one I have, which is Exmark, they're all basically the same. Like the design is the same. There's a few little things that are different here and there. But the cool thing about all of these machines is they're cam based. So what that means is that there's this little like pin at the bottom that you put in, and the cam with the weight on it, the lever arm, rotates around this pin. So if there's, you can use, it's really hard to explain. Basically, if you put a different size plate on the pin, it changes your resistance curve. So if you put no plates on the pin and you just let the machine act as it naturally would in its natural state, it's going to be severely shortened overload. There's going to be almost no resistance at the bottom of the rep. And then if you do something like put a 25-pound plate on, like a pretty big one, but not as big as like a 35 or 45, right? A 25 makes it pretty lengthened overload. It's about as lengthened as you can get with this machine without, if I went more lengthened, there would be no resistance at the top. So it would be all at the bottom, but then the top, you know, you would get to the top and it would be like a feather, and it would almost try to rotate over the opposite way. Like it would be like you would kick the leg extension machine over and the cam would rotate over the wrong way. So I operate between having none if I want short overload, all the way up to like a 25 if I want like a mid-range or lengthened overload.
Last kind of little follow-up question there. Would you say the majority of your general gym's leg extension machines are shortened overload or lengthened overload?
You know, I always thought they were shortened overload. And then I heard Cass say on a Q&A the other day that he thinks that most of the leg extension machines in gyms are more mid-range or lengthened overload. So I think that it depends on the machine, but one way that you can really quickly find out is when you finish a set to failure, do a couple partial reps. And if you can barely even get that thing to move a quarter of the range of motion on your first partial rep, then it's probably lengthened overload. And if you can get it, you know, 3/4 of the way, and then, you know, 3/5 of the way, and then 2/5 of the way, and you can basically just keep like chipping away at range of motion, then it's probably overloaded in the shortened position.
The last thing I will add there, and please don't quote me on this, I'm fairly certain, but not 100%, depending on the shape of the cam of the machine. So if it's like a perfect circle, it is probably a very even resistance curve. If it is more like egg-shaped or lopsided in some way, then you're probably going to be overloaded in one or the other more than like an equal resistance curve.
That's interesting. I never knew that. And I think honestly, to be truthful, I've probably only used 3 or 4 different leg extension machines at, you know, gyms in my life, because I was in CrossFit and then I was in a gym for a short amount of time and then I've been training at home. So I don't have a ton of experience with them.
That makes sense. Okay. So next question for you, Brian. If we have a young training age, will ME, muscular endurance, training translate to overall max strength? If so, for how long?
Yep. You skipped question 2 as well, so we need to go back to that one after this.
I said, okay, I'm going to go to 3, come back to 2, and then I just did not. I'm sorry. We will come back to number 2.
You're cool. So if you have a young training age, the thing is, like, there's actually a study. This is wild, because there's actually a study that they took untrained people that were sedentary. So not even like people that like live a relatively active life, but just don't lift weights. These are like sedentary people. and they started having them run. So one group started to run and the other group started to lift weights, and they got the same muscular gains at the end of whatever this period was just from running, because they were sedentary and like literally doing anything was going to build muscle in their body. I believe these adaptations, you know, are very, very short term. I don't know how long the study was, but I couldn't imagine that this lasted longer than 4 or 5, 6 weeks at most. So yes, in the early stages, anything works. I can't give you an exact number of how long this is going to work for, but I can say that training for muscular endurance, like with weights, is more specific to getting strong than running is. So your runway is going to be extended by training with weights at all, even if you're doing sets of 30 to 40, and that's going to be more productive than running is. Then if you did sets of 20, that would be more productive than doing sets of 30 to 40 if you're looking for translation to strength and maxes. But ultimately, if you can follow my path here, is we're working towards specificity. And as training age increases, specificity must increase. So for somebody like Aaron or myself, if we're doing sets of 10 to 15, I would expect zero increase in my overall max. Like maybe I would get better at I would get stronger at performing sets of 10 to 15 because that's what I'm performing. It's specific to that, but I wouldn't expect any transfer from doing a set of 10 to my one rep max. If I want to improve my one rep max, I need to be doing sets of 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 reps. And they need to be within, you know, X amount of reps of failure, et cetera, et cetera. So, as your training age increases, you need to get more specific, and that's the best answer I can give you.
I don't have anything to add there. Okay. Back to question two. Do you find for yourself and clients that training 6 out of 7 days is too much?
Yeah, short answer, yes. I mean, I think there are absolutely ways that you can do it because frequency is just a way to split volume. So if we took the same amount of volume that I'm doing on a 3-day program, like right now, my strength cycle, I'm doing a 3-day a week full body strength cycle. I actually had a few moments considering, and I actually think about this every session I do. I get through my squats and deadlifts and I'm like, man, I should just do the upper body stuff tomorrow. Like I don't need to do this right now. And then the problem with that is that then, okay, I do, you know, squats and deads on Monday. I do upper body on Tuesday. Then I'm back to doing legs on Wednesday, then upper body Thursday, then legs on Friday, upper body Saturday. Well, okay, the volume's the same. But for me, it essentially comes down to a psychology thing, because I really don't like training 6 days a week. I lose motivation to train. I stop enjoying it. And I would much rather spend 2 hours 3 days a week than 1 hour 6 days a week. That's my preference. If looking at what is optimal for hypertrophy, I would say that 3 is probably not optimal because you need to do a certain amount of volume and it would be tough to fit all that volume into 3 days. Which I think 3 days is much more conducive to a strength cycle like I'm doing, because the volume is significantly lower. If I was doing a hypertrophy phase, it would have at least 4 or 5. It would have 4 or 5 days of training a week. Cause that's just what I need to split my volume and not feel like I'm burning out and losing desire to train.
Awesome. So for my clients, I would say a majority, yes, probably too much relative to their lifestyle and their goals. For me, kind of the complete opposite of Brian. So I would rather go to the gym 6 days per week for like 50 minutes to an hour than 3 days per week for 2 hours. Because I know at about the like hour and 20, hour and 30 mark, my desire to train drops off pretty significantly. So like for instance, right now I'm only training 4 days per week, but they're longer sessions. And oftentimes, like 9 out of 10 times when it comes around to like that second to last and last exercise, like I straight up do not want to be there. And I kind of like I really, really like push pull legs. That's my favorite training split. And then you run that, you know, push pull legs off, push pull legs. I would say when I do run that, I generally end up training around 6 days, every 8 days, 6 sessions every 8 days. So not, you know, quite 6 out of 7, but that is by far my favorite. And I think what's really the best way to answer it is what your preference comes down to. Cause we have like Brian and myself, right? Kind of polar opposites. Brian prefers 3 days for 2 hours and I prefer like 6 days for 1 hour. So it really comes down to like preference, I think.
Yeah. I think psychology really is the number one underlying piece here. Physiologically, it becomes relevant if like, you know, you're getting to an hour and a half into your session and then you're actually seeing performance decrement and it's not like just your mind quitting on you, but like physiologically, you're just not getting the output anymore. But I think for most people, it's going to be psychological and preference. And then really quick, I want to touch on the push-pull legs thing, because that's also one of my favorite splits, but I really like to do it with push-pull rest, legs rest, so that it's three sessions over 5 days and then repeat. So I think that volume ends up being slightly lower than yours, because I'm 3 out of 5, whereas you're 6 out of 8. But again, I guess personal preference is interesting.
The last little bit I will add there is, if you are like dieting or something like that, recovery capacity could become a little bit of a concern there. So, or if you've been running it for a very, very long time, it would be a decent idea to pull back to like a 4 or 5 day or something like that. I don't think you should just run 6 days out of 7 for 365 days out of the year.
Yep.
Cool. Next question. Thoughts on Jeff Nippard style full body training 5 times per week?
Yeah, we had a full episode where we talked about different splits. I think it was, again, like, you know, episode 8 through 15 range or something like that, like maybe almost a year ago at this point. But I talked about kind of some of the drawbacks, because I've done this and I've tried it with clients too. And we all kind of seem to have the same issue, which is that exercise selection becomes so, so important that you almost are unable to do a lot of the exercises that you want to do because they're so fatiguing. So then you could just kind of say, okay, dude, I get it, but then I'll just work less hard on those exercises. So, okay, cool. You work less hard on those exercises, but now you're essentially like 4 or 5 RIR. So when I implemented this myself, I thought I was taking a prudent approach, and I started at like 3 RIR for most lifts. And I was just the first week or two, I was just constantly beat up. And it wasn't even like good beat up, where I was just like mildly sore and excited to train. It was like, you know, I do 1 or 2 sets of leg press to 3 RIR, and I'm sore for like 3 days. So then I'm supposed to come in and do like leg curls the next day, and then leg extensions after that. And then I'm supposed to squat the day after that. And even when you look at putting exercises in an order that is conducive to this. So I think we talked about this example, like where hamstring movements have to be very targeted and specific to what the for what the frequency is. Cause like, no matter what hamstring movement you do, unless it's a leg curl, like if it's a lengthened overload hamstring movement, you're just going to be sore from it. Like an RDL or a GHR or a weighted hip extension or a stiff legged deadlift or a good morning, like any of those big compound hamstring movements are going to put you on the floor, even if you did 2 sets to 4 or 5 RIR. So it is doable, but you have to start literally at 5 RIR. Like that has to be your starting point, so you can build repeated bout effect and all that sort of stuff. Exercise selection becomes super duper important. Like where would you put a dumbbell fly or something? Like it's lengthened overload. You're going to be sore for 2 or 3 days from a dumbbell fly. So, you know, you have to start opting for like cable crossovers, and, you know, where do you put your presses? And there's just a lot of considerations that you have to put in there. And then I would say the main mitigating factor, because I think those two factors can be worked around through good programming. The main factor for me was that going into it, one of my main exciting aspects of it was that I was like, I'm never going to have a full leg day. Like, it's great, you know? Well, what ended up turning out was that every day felt like leg day, because it was either like I'm doing leg curls and leg extensions, or I'm doing leg press, or I'm doing a stiff legged deadlift, or whatever it is. Like, I'm always working legs, and it always feels like mentally you have to bring it. Whereas it's really nice for me on like a push pull leg split or like an upper lower, where the upper days, they just don't take as much out of you, and you can kind of like save it up mentally. Again, coming to psychology, which I think is ultimately the biggest factor here as well. But like, you just have to be able to bring that intensity 5 days a week. And that's hard. It's just hard.
Yeah. The adaptation period of it is longer. It might take a full like 2 weeks to get used to it. Personally, I agree with Brian. I'm not a fan. I never say never, right? I've ran it in the past. I may do some again, you know, for some reason in the future, but it's just not my favorite type of thing, mostly because of that psychological thing, like Brian said. It's hard when you have to mentally prepare for leg stuff like every single day. So like Brian said. Anything else, sir?
Yeah, I mean, I agree totally. Yeah, let's move on to the next one.
Thoughts on single set to failure training?
I think it's great. I think it can work really well, especially for people that are a little low on time. So every study has basically shown that one set gives you somewhere between like 70 and 80 plus percent of the benefit of doing 3, 4, 5, 6 sets. So in that sense, like, okay, and let's actually backtrack a second. If someone is doing a study and they think studies are all to failure, right? Because that's the protocol. You go to failure in studies. What's in reality, when you actually talk to people that do studies, very rarely are people actually at failure. What's happening is people are like, oh, this is really hard now. That seems like failure. I'm going to stop. And as a scientist, you can't exactly just be like, no, you have to keep going. I mean, I think there's like moral issues against that. And your number one goal is to not get someone injured. So when they say they're at failure, you're like, cool, you're at failure. If you as a trainee, someone like me or you, you know, we're going into it and we say we're going to do one set to failure. Well, one set to failure means there's 3, 4, 5 ramp up sets that occur leading to that. No, they're not work sets. They don't necessarily cause growth. But you're preparing to put the ultimate effort into one set. So that effort that you're putting into that set is probably higher than what the studies are doing for their 6 sets. And they're still saying that one set to failure, probably even conducted shy of failure in the studies, is, you know, giving you 70 or 80% of the benefits of 6 sets. Now you're taking your one set to like the house. I would guess that that one set is as stimulative as 3 or 4 sets that are done within a research lab. So I think that that's one thing that you need to keep in mind is how much intensity can you bring to that set? If you're a novice to training and you're like, I'm going to do one set to failure, like you'll probably get benefits for a little while because you're a novice and everything works. But if you don't learn how to actually like really get to failure, eventually that's probably not going to work. So it's a skill to be able to take yourself to failure. And if you can do that, I think single set to failure works great.
Two things I want to add there. I think for this, it's important to choose your rep ranges and weights appropriately. For example, like let's say you're on a hack squat, right? And I'm going to do a single set to failure and you do like 6 reps. The failure is more or less from like the weight. If you're going to be like, hey, I'm going to do a set to failure and it's like 9 to 12 reps, it's going to be a night and day type of scenario. And, you know, the metabolic, the metabolite buildup, like you're basically how awful you feel when performing it. Second thing is, I think this is going to make primarily from a safety standpoint, but also from a being able to push standpoint. If you're training like this, training with a partner is going to be orders of magnitude more helpful because they are going to say, okay, you have 2 reps, you know, you have 2 reps left, something like that, based on your rep speed type of deal. And like you gauging your rep speed yourself when you're in like the suck of it way too hard. I think it just the productivity you get out of this style of training with a partner would be infinitely more productive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that if you're just going to do one set as well, you should take advantage of things like occasionally, not all the time, but maybe at the end of a meso, you know, you're using your partner to get a couple forced reps in on the hack, like partials, you know, across leg extensions and pull downs and things like that. So using more intensity techniques.
Yeah. Cool. Best pull-up progression, bands, negatives, something else?
Yeah. So this person didn't list my favorite one, the one that I always recommend, which is rack pull-ups. The rack pull-up is the one that's going to translate most effectively into a regular pull-up. So the problem with bands is that the resistance curve is backwards. So at the bottom of a banded pull-up, you have a ton of help, but you don't really need all that help at the bottom. What you really need is that help at the top when the band isn't giving you any. So the band is awful. Like I very rarely see people make significant gains in their pull-up progress by using bands. I love negatives, but I think negatives are best for like low rep strength work. I think if you're looking to improve your 1 rep or 2 rep max pull up, then negatives and then subsequently weighted negatives are really, really great. But for most people, you know, if you're looking for increased pull up strength through the full range of motion with an even strength curve, that's going to translate most directly to a pull up, then doing rack pull ups is for sure the best one.
Yeah, I really like rack pulls. It's one of my like favorite, like, you know, kind of, I don't want to say like old school style, like hypertrophy pulling type things that you can do in like a home gym or something like that, CrossFit gym really easily. So I would agree with you there.
Yeah, you can actually kind of bias the lats a little bit too, which is something that you can't do very well in a CrossFit gym. You can kind of angle your torso and put it into flexion, so you can really kind of follow the iliac lat, like the lower lat focused kind of requirements of like a neutral grip and elbow driving into waistline and stuff like that. And like even in a regular pull up, you can't really do that. So I think a rack pull up has unique benefit in that way as well.
Next question, resources you would recommend for coaches wanting to expand their training knowledge?
Yeah, there's a bunch of really good ones. So N1 is obviously the one that first comes to mind because we talk about them a lot, but there's a company out in the UK called the Muscle Mentors, and they run an education portal, much like N1 does, where they take you through a bunch of modules. They have like a membership site with like tons of, you know, lectures and scientific references and et cetera, et cetera. Video demos of movement, stuff like that. So Muscle Mentors, I've heard nothing but good stuff about them. And I think they've actually collaborated with Cass on something here or there. I've heard them talk about like movement patterns and working together on stuff and things like that. So they're very biomechanics focused as well. I think that the 3DMJ Vault is a great place. So 3DMJ is a coaching company that does, you know, mostly natural bodybuilding and powerlifting. And they have a vault that I think is $8.99 a month that you can get access to and has all sorts of the same things like lectures and video demos of movements and blogs and stuff like that. And then they also have a book called The Muscle and Strength Pyramids, which is a multi-part series that covers basically everything you need to know about training. Scott Stevenson has a book called Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach, which I just bought for $100 off Amazon because I've absorbed so much knowledge from this man, Scott Stevenson, over the years. And I honestly don't know. Like, I haven't read the book yet. I just bought it because I wanted to support him and I wanted to kind of say thank you for like letting me absorb all your knowledge from all these podcasts for free for so many years. So I'm pretty sure that that book's going to be awesome because Scott is on a whole different level. But those would be my main recommendations.
Those are really, really solid recommendations. One that now being fully transparent here, I don't have any personal experience, but I've heard a lot of really good stuff around is the Hypertrophy Coach app. I believe his name is Joe Bennett, but please don't quote me on that. In this very interesting new world where you know people by their Instagram handles, if their Instagram handle is not their name, you don't know what their actual name is. So I've heard pretty cool things about that as well. But I mean, I think all the resources Brian listed are going to be fantastic. And like we said, I'm going to N1 to learn. I couldn't be more excited. You know, I'm very, very excited. So yeah, tons of really good people out there.
Did you know that? Awesome stuff. Yeah. Did you know that Cass and Joe Bennett, Hypertrophy Coach, came up together in Florida?
I did not know that, actually.
Yeah. So they were working under the same company, MI40, with Ben Pekulski.
I did hear some of the grumblings of the old school.
Yeah, and yeah. Cass no longer associates with either of those guys. Yeah. They had a big falling out.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that happens, I'm sure, for legitimate reason. Yeah, but
anyway, I just thought that was an interesting aside. Yeah. Cool. Next question.
Best way to gauge reps in reserve if new to this type of training?
Yeah, this question is from my dude Jason. He just started one of my Evolve programs. So the best obvious way is anchoring, which we're not doing in my program. So I'll expand beyond that in a second. But anchoring essentially means you test each movement to failure and then you know what failure is. And then it becomes really easy to be like, okay, I got 11 reps to failure. So 8 is 3 RIR or whatever. But what we do in my programs, because this is obviously a common question, is we start every mesocycle, which is like a 4 or 5 week period, at 2 or 3 reps in reserve. So you just take your best guess at whatever 2 or 3 reps is. You know, maybe you're at 5, maybe you're at 1. I don't know. Like, it would be tough for me to see someone at 1, like to watch them do a back squat and have them, you know, do a 1 RIR and be like, yep, that was 5. So I don't know. I kind of don't think that one's going to happen, but more likely you're going to err on the side of like, you know, I think I'm trying to do 2 to 3, but I'm really doing 5. And so what happens in my programs to mitigate this as an issue entirely is we just add weight every week. So if you start at 3 RIR and then you add 5 pounds or 10 pounds, depending on the lift, every single week for 4 or 5 weeks, eventually you're going to butt yourself up against failure. And that's what we do in the final week of the cycle before deload. We take all the repeating movements. We take a set to failure. And then that acts as your anchoring for the next cycle. So we go through deload week, we recover, we come back into the second cycle, we keep the same movements, the repeating movements that we did in the first cycle. But now you can kind of look at your performance from the week prior to deload and be like, okay, I either sandbagged the shit out of my prior weeks or I was pretty spot on. And then you can kind of assess from there what progression you need to make in the next mesocycle over the 4 or 5 week period to build yourself back up to essentially try and exceed what you did the prior mesocycle.
Yeah, that first meso is going to be a data gathering and learning meso. And yep. Then you'll be able to, because especially with the, not nervous system adaptations. What do we call them? The neural adaptations. Yeah. That'll take place over that first mess. So anyway, you just got to pick some numbers and see, and then the second mess will be much more accurate and appropriate for you.
Exactly. Yep.
Cool. Do we recommend warming up and stretching before, or just starting with a light weight for the first movement? Second part of the question, stretch before or after training?
Yeah. You know, I've talked a lot about my feelings on warming up, and I think that what it ultimately comes down to is an as-needed basis. It depends on the type of training you're doing, and it depends on how your body is feeling, how your body's made up. As a personal example, right, like in CrossFit, when we did a bunch of Olympic lifting and the first thing we would do in the day was snatch, I would spend 30 or 40 minutes with bands and stretching and foam rolling and sitting with an empty barbell over my head and like all sorts of just asinine things that wasted so much of my time. And then, you know, contrast that with straight up hypertrophy training, almost even like metabolite. Say we're going to do sets of, you know, 12 to 25. The amount of warming up that I would need to do for a set of 12 on almost any movement is nothing. Like I would do an empty bar and then some light weight and work up from there. And then maybe somewhere in the middle is what I'm doing right now, which is powerlifting more or less. You know, I'm working up to really heavy weights in a low bar back squat and a deadlift and more complex movements. And so just to get my body into position for a low bar back squat, like I have to start essentially my first set with my hands out really wide. And then each set I'm able to move my hands in, maybe, you know, an inch or two, something like that. And by the time I get to my actual top work set, my hands are in nice and tight. The bar is jammed into my back and I feel like really strong and secure. What I'm doing in between each of these warm-up sets is I'm acutely targeting the areas that are limiting me to get the bar into position. So I'm doing my low bar squat. I'm like, oh, my right shoulder feels tight, like on the anterior side. Okay. So I'm going to take a lacrosse ball. I'm going to lean against the wall and I'm going to jam that into my anterior delt and I'm going to loosen that up. Okay. That feels better. Now my posterior delt on my left side is acting up or whatever. So like, as I go through the progressions and add weight to the bar, I'm assessing what areas feel limited, and then I'm targeting those specific areas. So it all kind of goes back to the as needed basis of warming up, which is what do you need to best prepare yourself to succeed in that session?
Yeah, this one is interesting. And I agree 100% with Brian. Back in the CrossFit and Olympic lifting days, I needed a half hour to warm up. And the majority of the reason why is because my body felt like a hot pile of fucking garbage every single day. Now I feel great pretty much all the time. And with the more hypertrophy style, it's just more forgiving for this. So what I'll usually do is I'll walk for maybe 7 minutes or something like that. If it's a leg day, I might do 3 to 4 minutes on like a spin bike just to like get some blood into my legs. I move through my end ranges of motion a couple times. So if I'm doing like yesterday, I was doing some chest pressing first. I did some like some arm circles, but not like, you know, with momentum, like slow end range of motion, moving my shoulders through their like, you know, full circle range of motion. Then I'll usually hop on like a cable type machine where I can hit the selectorized weight, and I'll just do like sets of four and increase over time. Like I picked this up from John Meadows. It's a really, really great thing to get blood moving. And then I jump into my first exercise and, you know, do maybe a couple low warm-up sets, and then I start moving. It's really relative to how you're feeling. I'd say you probably need a little bit more, like the two areas you really want to pay attention to, your shoulders and then maybe like your knees and low back type of stuff, depending on what you're doing. And I just move slowly through a couple reps until I feel good and go from there. It's a night and day difference from, you know, 7-8 years ago. I don't do much warming up at all because my movement patterns are much slower. I'm pausing, you know, in different things. It's really relative to the style of training you're doing. And then for the second part, I don't really stretch ever unless I go to a yoga class. There are times where I'll like, you know, hit the lacrosse ball and like my heels, feet, ankles type of things a little bit, especially if we were doing a lot of hiking. I do have a little bit of tightness in like my traps and rhomboids I'll roll out on. But besides that, I might do that for 2-3 minutes a day. Like I go to one yoga class per week. That's it.
Cool. Yeah, I would say the one thing with stretching, static stretching, is you don't want to do it before training because it actually has been shown to decrease contractile force when you static stretch shortly after, not permanently, but for like, you know, for 15 or 30 minutes after doing it. So you definitely don't want a static stretch before training. You could do dynamic stretching with like some movement and flows and stuff like that. I occasionally do static stretch. It's not something I do for training. It's mostly something I do to, cause it feels good. My favorite way to do it is in the shower. I like to literally just have the water pouring over my head and I will stretch for 5 minutes, you know, some sitting on the ground, some standing, some like twisting and hip stuff. And, I love that. It makes me feel amazing. And then I get out of the shower and I feel loose and good. And yeah, that's my thoughts on that.
Cool. Best rep range for novices.
It's an interesting question. I mean, the answer is whatever rep range you can execute movement best in. So I think that a set of six is probably too heavy. Like you're probably not going to have the coordination yet to be able to get the most out of a set of like 6 or 8. I also think a set of 20 to 30 is probably going to be so light that you're just going to kind of be like moving around like a wet noodle kind of. So I would guess like if I had to put a rep range on it, like 10 to 15 seems pretty good to me.
Yeah. I don't really have much for that. I would say relative to your goals.
Yep.
Would you ever use eccentric only training, maybe at the end of a set?
Personally, no. I think this would be something relevant maybe for that person that asked about single set to failure training. So maybe that's something that you add in at the end. For anyone wondering, eccentric only is essentially like, so he's asking maybe at the end of a set, but eccentric only training in its basis is going to be just focusing on the lowering portion of a movement. So picture a bench press. And so you put a bunch of weight on the bar, maybe even more than you can lift, but you can lower down more weight than you can lift. So then you lower it down and then someone helps you lift it back up again. And then you lower it back down and someone helps you lift it up again. This type of training is extremely damaging. A ton of muscle soreness, a ton of muscle damage, so much so that I think it would have to be built into progressively over time if you did want to do this. And I think that if you did it, you would have to take recovery into consideration as like a paramount concern because you may not be able to train that muscle group again for more days than you would if you hadn't done the eccentrics.
I will say I don't ever do it. The one thing I do sometimes is on my final rep, when I know I'm done, I will like do like a very slow targeted eccentric lowering. Like the hack squat is the one that comes to mind. Like after I know, okay, I hit my 6 reps, my 8 reps, I'm going to pull the stops in, you know, and lower like really, really slowly. I will do that on some like maybe 6 to 8 reps. Rep type stuff. Am I doing that at the end of like a leg extension or something like that where I'm at like 12 reps? Yeah. Absolutely not. But that's the only time I'll ever do something like that.
Yeah. I think eccentric only training would mean that there isn't a concentric, which then takes away like a huge piece of the hypertrophy puzzle. So I would not be doing that if that was
my goal. I don't think I would ever have do like just straight negatives or anything like that.
Yeah.
How would you gauge weights for back offset on primary lift?
Yeah, so this is the way I tend to program these days a lot in many of my programs. So we'll have like a top set of 6 to 10 and then a back offset of 8 to 12 or 10 to 15. So I think in most cases, you know, a back offset should be 15 to 20% less, depending on how the first set goes. Like if it was 6 to 10 on the top set and you got 10, then I might only drop it, you know, 10 to 15% for the back offset. Whereas if it was 6 to 10 and I got 6, then I might need to drop it 25% for the back offset. So I think it depends on those two scenarios and then kind of what your target rep ranges are.
Yeah, I don't really, I think that's a perfect explanation there. Yeah. Cool.
All right, lifestyle questions. Let me ask a couple of these to you and we can go back and forth on them. We're almost done here. I'm getting adequate total sleep, but very little deep sleep. Thoughts, tips, effects?
This one is really hard for me to answer. I don't have much to really suggest here. If you're getting like 8, 9, 7.5 hours of sleep, I wouldn't put too much into it. Now, granted, I'm sure there's like a sleep researcher or something like that who will completely crucify me on my words here. What I'm saying is it's just not something that I currently understand sufficiently at a level to really give you tips here. But if you ever find anything cool, please let me know.
Yeah, for sure. I'm curious as well. I know that I've listened to a lot of the stuff that Greg Potter has done. He's out of the UK. So I would look up Greg Potter's work because he's a kind of sleep expert out there. And my other thought would be that if you're using an app to tell you that you're not getting a lot of deep sleep, but you are getting, you know, 7 to 8 hours and it's just being told it's not deep, I don't know. Like, that's one of those things where I feel like this is why I've been so shy to use a sleep app. I've never used one before because in my head, like, I'm in bed for 8 hours a night. I sleep most of the time from 9 to 5. Like, that's pretty much my sleep. I wake up a couple times, but I wake up feeling well rested. And I don't want some app to tell me, like, you didn't get a lot of deep sleep. You feel like shit today. And I'm like, no, I feel great actually, but maybe I should feel like shit. I don't know. You know, like, I don't want to start second guessing myself because of an app. I'd rather subjectively assess how I'm feeling and kind of go.
That's a perfect thing to add. Now, if you're sleeping 8 hours and you wake up and you feel like absolute dog shit and you sleep and you feel like you need another 8 hours, like, that could be something indicative. But yeah, with using an app or something like that, there could be some, you know, user error, could be some configuration thing. So if you're sleeping an adequate volume, you wake up feeling great, I wouldn't put too much into it.
Yep. Best tip for a good night's sleep.
My kind of tips there are going to be, you want to monitor your caffeine intake and how far into the day you are having caffeine intake. Minimize your blue light exposure once the sun goes down. So if you are watching TV, still working on your phone, a set of blue blockers would be really, really helpful there. Finding out what your personal threshold is for your final meal to proximity of sleep. So I have clients who cannot really eat within 2 hours of sleep or it will really mess with their sleep. Myself, I'll eat 20 minutes before I go to bed and sleep perfectly fine. So that one's going to be a little bit more individual. This is a new one for me. I got a sleep mask. I posted about it on Instagram last week. It's been like a holy grail thing for me. I'm a very light and sound sensitive sleeper. So I've done a lot of experimenting with earplugs in the past, but I'd never been like super, super consistent with it. But now every night, earplugs, face mask, and there'll be sometimes like on the weekend, if I don't set an alarm or whatever, I'll finally wake up and I'll pull the face mask off and it'll be like broad daylight. And I'm like, holy fuck, it's like 9 a.m. So, and that's like complete opposite. Cause before it'd be, especially in the summertime when the sun will come up earlier, it'll start peeking through it like a little after 6 and it'll wake me up. So that sleep mask has been a game changer for me. So I would start with those more hygiene and habit-based things before moving into any kind of supplements or anything like that. Anything from you, Brian?
Yeah. No, I agree. You basically covered all the ones I was going to say as well.
Cool.
Best recovery protocols: foam roll, sauna, muscle stim. What else?
So what's really funny here is people always go to these things. Your best recovery protocols are adequate sleep volume and quality, yep, and calories and food quality and, yep, micronutrients. Like, those are going to do orders of magnitude more for you than like a muscle stim or a foam roller or something like that will. That being said, I am a fan of the sauna. I think it's something that's really cool, especially because, like, let's say you have a house, right, and you have a garage and stuff. They are becoming more like affordable type of thing. There is a lot of cool research coming out with saunas, especially if you follow like Dr. Rhonda Patrick has some cool stuff on that. But, you know, I'm always going to start with sleep, adequate calories, micronutrient density, and macronutrient distribution. Some simple walks before I really go down the rabbit hole of all these, like, you know, fucking boots and shit like that that people wear and stuff, before moving into these things that move the needle less than the big rocks type of items.
I agree completely. I personally love heat. So saunas, steam showers, hot tubs, these things are so much better in the research now, and I just enjoy them. But like, in general, like when you look at the research, it's literally not even arguable now that cold dunks blunt hypertrophy. Like if you go and put yourself through an ice bath, you may as well not have even worked out, because it's like you took 1,000 ibuprofen and just stunted the, what's the word I'm looking for? The inflammation response. Yes. Yeah, so heat is good. We have a 7-sprocket shower in my house, and it also turns into a steam shower, which is insane. So I've been doing that. Anytime I feel like anything, like a tickle in my sore throat or like a nose is clogged or anything, I go turn that jank up to like 110 and spend 10 minutes in there. And by the end, you know, all of that stuff has just dripped out of me and I feel amazing. So I'm a huge fan of stuff like that. And, you know, I'll foam roll and stretch kind of like we mentioned before, but I don't really do it as a way necessarily like pre-training to like stimulate training. It's just kind of something I do as I'm like watching TV and I'm like, man, it'd be really cool to like crack my back right now. And I'll go like, foam roll that out for like 5 minutes and kind of get a couple areas and move on with life. I don't know how much it actually helps. From what I understand in the studies, foam rolling is an acute effect, meaning that it has been shown to help your positioning within minutes of doing it. But there aren't any like long-term benefits of like, say you foam roll yesterday, that it's going to somehow have an impact tomorrow or a month from now or anything like that.
Yeah. Cool. Last question I think we have here. How do you stay motivated, with a capital motivated, all in caps, to train solo?
Yeah. It's interesting because you kind of train solo too. So I think we can both add some perspective here. But this question is coming from a guy that I've known for a really long time. He used to be a one-on-one client of mine during the CrossFit days, and he was a regional athlete. And so I think I'm just going to go out on a limb here. I think he's struggling a little bit with training in a manner that still allows him to be the person he was 7-8 years ago, still be able to maintain the skills of snatching and muscle ups and these types of things. And so that's a thing that you and I both went through, is this kind of identity crisis of still being tied to these skills that we want to be good at. And so the only thing I can say really is that I'm training in a manner that I enjoy. If I was trying to do CrossFit training in my garage on my own, I think I would really struggle with that because I don't exactly enjoy it. So I truly look forward to my sessions, and I don't even have to make this up. Like, I'm not even just saying like, I look forward to my sessions. Like I really do. Like I get excited about the opportunity to put headphones on, to take a hit of weed, to improve myself and better myself, almost like a person going out to play golf. Like, you're not trying to play golf against other people necessarily. You might be, but you just go out there because it's peaceful and it's your time. And you try to get better than you did the time before. And those types of things drive me. It speaks to my introverted side. And, I would recommend this person to pick a type of training that they enjoy and maybe not try to train in a manner that they feel like they should be training in, but to train in the way that speaks to them.
That is such a fantastic answer. A couple things that I will add. It does help. I am very introverted. I heard a quote very recently that I really liked. It said, if you can't spend time by yourself, you're not in good company. And don't get me wrong, that is a lot of confirmation bias for myself, but I love spending time by myself. And training is just like a part of how I can do that. I get to listen to music. I get to work on myself, and I really, really like that. And it's shifted over the years. Now it's a lot more from like the health and longevity standpoint, you know, as I'm like, Brian, you're 39, right? So like, yep. I mean, I'm 33 right now. I want to look like Brian when I'm 39, right? I have clients who are in their like 40, like 47, 48 are in incredible shape. And I'm like, now it's like shifting. Like how long can I maintain this aspect of my youth? You know, can I be a dad who's got kids in their teens and stuff like that and still be in really great shape and be a positive, you know, role model in terms of how I take care of myself, how I prioritize my health sort of thing. So it's more than just like the, oh, I want to look good. You know, that is a secondary aspect that comes along, you know, more easily now. But I've always loved lifting weights, and it's shifted in different times. You know, I couldn't do CrossFit right now. And I think what it really came down to is like, I didn't want to, you know, and I think everyone goes through their different methodologies or their different, you know, character arcs of training. But I don't know, CrossFit was really fantastic for me in that point of my life. I think it more than anything, it played into being able to compete as being like a high school athlete that, and then was now no longer an athlete type of thing. And then that ran its course. And then now it's just like, I just love lifting weights. Since like the first couple times I did it, I loved lifting weights. I think I always will. And it just fills a lot of gaps and holes in my life. I don't mean that in like a bad way. It's just a wholly positive net benefit in my life. And I think at this point, like I would enjoy training with someone like every once in a while. But I think if I had the choice to like train by myself or like a daily partner, I'm going to choose training by myself, to be completely honest.
It would take the right person. Like, I feel like if you were local and we could be on like the same routine and train at the same time together, and we could also kind of have our introverted space while we're training, but just have like the other person there as like an accountability piece, I feel like that would work really well. But for sure, I could see a number of different types of personalities that would not vibe with me. And I would just be like, yo, let me be by myself here.
Yeah. You know?
So no, totally. That was a great answer. And I agree. Like, it really is just like, it's so positive in my life. And I think about this all the time. Like, sometimes I'll say things like, people will ask me a question and it's not even related to training, but I use the way that I think about training as like an analogy in my head when I create my response to them. And then I'm like, oh, well, because of training, I was able to come up with this really cool answer that was completely unrelated to training. And I just think it's provided me so many life benefits like that along the way as well.
Yeah. It's, I love it. And I mean, at the end of the day, just for the health standpoint, bone mineral density, which is going to be so vital as we age, you know, metabolic efficiency, like all these different things. It's just like every single person should in some capacity be doing some form of resistance training. And if you just look at it from that standpoint, the positives are just astounding.
Yep.
Cool. Yep. Anything to add on this one, Brian?
No, man, I love rapid fire questions. We weren't actually as rapid as I thought we would be.
Of course.
But I think we did. I think we did a good job. And I think next time we get a bombardment of a barrage of questions, we should do a similar type format, because it's kind of cool, instead of picking and choosing like the best six, to just be like, fuck it, we're gonna answer all of them.
Yeah, I agree. I really did my damnedest. I'll have to go back through and listen to the episode. Well, I obviously do when I edit it. I believe I never said the word especially on this episode, and I tried
especially.
I tried really fucking hard too. So we'll see what happens. So
I love
with that, guys. Thank you for listening as always. Brian and I will talk to you next week. Thank you so much for listening to Eat, Train, Prosper. If you found this episode valuable, please subscribe or share us with your friends. You can find more from Aaron at StrakerNutritionCo.com and more from Brian at EvolvedTrainingSystems.com. Talk to you guys next time.